This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last night was predicted to be a win for Democratic presidential contender Bernie Sanders in the New Hampshire primary. And in the words of the candidate, it was a huge win.
Because of a huge voter turnout, and I say huge, we won because we harnessed the energy and the excitement that the Democratic Party will need to succeed in November.
Bernie Sanders went into primary day with a lead in the polls, but as we all know, polls are a snapshot in time of likely voters, not a fait accompli. But he pulled it out and then some, coming in ahead of Hillary Clinton by more than 25 percentage points. On the Republican side, there were eight contenders generally considered to be actually in the running. Trump was top of the list for the GOP voters in New Hampshire with a convincing margin between him and second place finisher Ohio Governor John Kasich. Cruz, Bush, and Rubio duked it out for third. We're going to take a look at what the results tell us today. We'll hear from the speeches and from New Hampshire voters, and we'll take your reaction. So call now, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a comment on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Matt writes, the odds are stacked against him, but given a few recent gaffes on the Hillary side of things that'll further alienate young voters, Steinem and Albright's comments will have most likely left young women utterly disinterested in voting for Hillary, for example. I think that Bernie has a great shot at this. Matt says, I'd never have believed that a Democratic socialist would fare this well in the first place. So share your thoughts with us. What are you thinking coming out of New Hampshire? Does this change anything for you? Do you see this changing the momentum for any of the candidates? 1-800-639-2211. And I'm joined first today by Chris Galgieri, a professor of politics at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm's College. And he actually teaches a course in the New Hampshire primary as well. It's a pleasure to have you with us, Chris.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So anything surprising you from last night?
Honestly, the biggest surprise was how few surprises there were. if you had told me a year ago that Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders would win the New Hampshire primary, I would have avoided making eye contact and crossed the street to avoid you. And yet, here we are. So I think one of the amazing things is how unsurprising this was by the time all was said and done.
Even the margins, I mean, that seemed to be the question for most people was how big is the margin going to be for the Trump victory and for the expected Sanders victory?
That's right. And I think there was a feeling amongst a lot of people watching this election that maybe the Clinton team was going to close the gap, if not even if a victory was out of reach, maybe they could keep it to the high single digits or even the low teens and call that a comeback, much the way that Bill Clinton did back in 1992. And that just absolutely categorically did not happen. I think Sanders is on track to have one of the biggest, if not the biggest, margins of victory in the history of the New Hampshire primary.
And how important do you think that is?
I think it's a big deal. I think if it was a narrow victory, the Clinton campaign would say, look, we pulled it out, we got lazy in New Hampshire, or we didn't realize what was happening until it was too late, but we figured out what was going on, we addressed it, and we're going to just keep up what we're doing in the subsequent states. I suspect that there have been a lot of phone calls going on in the Clinton campaign today. There is a debate tomorrow. The next contest in Nevada is in a week and a half. They don't have a lot of time to figure out how they're going to respond to this new reality. They need to decide, how are they going to handle the Sanders campaign? Are they going to go negative? If they do go negative, how do you do that in a way that doesn't completely alienate his supporters? I think they're probably worried that they've been thinking that Nevada, with its large Hispanic population, South Carolina, with its large African-American population, are something of demographic firewalls for them. But I think now they've got to ask themselves, well, what if in the wake of all of the coverage of this primary, a lot of those people that we're expecting to vote for us like what Bernie Sanders is saying? Which is just what's happened with young voters.
And do you think that's a possibility? Because, I mean, when we look at what pundits have been saying and the media has been saying since Bernie Sanders started to run, it does seem like when he started running, people were generally saying, well, this is great. He'll come into the race. He has some ideas that'll push Hillary Clinton further to the left, and this will be good for the party, but there's no way he's even going to make it to Iowa. Now, Iowa and New Hampshire, it's like, well, yeah, sure. But those are two very white states. They're sort of outliers in this process. He's going to do well there, and he won't do well in South Carolina or on Super Tuesday. And now you're saying, wait a minute, you know, there should at least be pause in the Hillary Clinton campaign, and perhaps from the media analysts as well. You think it's a real possibility that some voters who are sort of staunchly considered to be in the Hillary Clinton camp might move over?
It's possible. I mean, you know, for instance, with Latino voters in Nevada, a lot of people point to the fact that she did very well with Latino voters in 2008, even at the end of the primary season, once, you know, Obama's campaign was, you know, well on its way to securing the nomination. But 8 years is a long time. And in a state like Nevada, you've got a very mobile population. You've got people moving in and out of the state. You've got lots of people with weird work hours, which matters in a caucus state where you've got to meet at an appointed time, on an appointed day, or else not participate. And I think they've got to really figure out how to use their resources in a way that gets the voters they need to the polls, but also try to counter or preempt the Sanders message and do it in a way that doesn't look like she's just saying, me too. And following Sanders' lead.
Which we did seem to hear some of last night in her, I guess it's sort of a concession speech, you know, so a lot more talk about Wall Street, her idea of how she could regulate Wall Street and make sure that things are fair for more people does seem to come right from the Bernie Sanders playbook.
Right. And I think, you know, in part that's an example of the sort of thing you were saying of Clinton's the Sanders campaign pushing Clinton to the left and being aware of these issues. I think what she lacks is, you know, she hasn't figured out how to sell that. I mean, what she's basically arguing is, you know, I'm an experienced person. I know how to get change to happen. Given the nature of our current political reality, that's going to be incremental change. We're probably going to face a Republican Congress, so you need someone who knows how the White House works, who knows how the executive branch works, and so on. That's a pretty good description of the reality the next president is going to face if he or she is a Democrat. But as a campaign message, it's basically eat your vegetables and you can have a Hershey's kiss. And, you know, Bernie Sanders, especially to young voters, it's exciting. He's promising a revolution. He's talking about, you know, injustice and inequity. And I think Clinton hasn't figured out how to counter that with something that is appealing.
Let's go to Jim calling in from Randolph. Hi, Jim. Go right ahead.
Hi, it's Randolph in Montpelier, so we're in transition. But just a quick explanation from the panel or guests on why you can have a 60-30 or 60-38 split and still have the delegates go 15-13 Hillary's way. That probably should be explained to some people. And the other thing, I still think the media is missing the mark, unfortunately, certainly on the age thing. I'm 55, and most of the people I know in several different states, Maryland, Missouri, New Jersey, certainly Vermont, they're Bernie people, and they're in their 40s and 50s and 60s, and my parents are in their 80s, and I think they're really missing the mark on the age thing. And if you look at the you know, the exit poll, that bears out too. And the other thing is, I think you got a 60 to 38 margin. I think the record, from what I'm seeing in my research, is 16% was the largest margin previous to this. I think if she was on the other foot, I think you'd be seeing headlines splashed everywhere. Hillary crushes Bernie by a record margin. Hillary, you know, you're not seeing that. And I'm wondering when the media is really going to wake up, really.
Jim, thanks for your comment. I appreciate it, and I hear what you're saying. So, you know, frustration that you're not seeing this headline splashing about how much of a margin it was, victory for Bernie Sanders, 60% to Hillary Clinton's 38%. But to Jim's question that he wanted you to clarify, Chris, was also, why did the delegate count then go to Hillary? And maybe this is just a point to explain very briefly the difference between the pledged delegates and the superdelegates.
Sure. First of all, pledged delegates are elected in primaries and caucuses, and the math for them is not a direct translation proportionally from the popular vote. So winning 60% of the vote doesn't guarantee you 60% of the delegates, and 30% of the vote doesn't guarantee you 30% of the delegates. Instead, there are thresholds, there are calculations based on performance within congressional districts. The number of delegates your state has is affected by whether or not it has a Democratic governor, whether it went for the Democrats in the last presidential election, and so on. So the math there is not a one-to-one correlation. I think one of the strengths the Clinton campaign has is that it has already received hundreds of pledges of support from superdelegates, which we all recall from 2008. These are office holders, party leaders, party officials who have an automatic unpledged vote at the Democratic convention. And most of those people, I believe it's most, if it's not most, it's really close to most, have already pledged their support for her. So what that means is that Clinton has, you can call it a cushion or a lead, of probably 300 or 400 votes out of the, I want to say, 2,500 that are needed for the Democratic nomination. But those are pledges. They are not, you know, contracts signed in blood. So if something were to, you know, if she were to start, you know, losing every primary by 60-38 margin, you know, we might see some of those folks move. But I think, you know, one of the things complicating things for Sanders is that he's not a, you know, he's not your standard issue presidential candidate. Until very recently, he insisted that he was an independent who happened to caucus with the Democrats. So it's a different situation than we saw in 2008, where the alternative to Clinton was a Democratic senator from Illinois who people were familiar with, who was explicitly a member of the party, who had done things like campaign for Democrats in 2004 and 2006. I think a lot of those superdelegates, even if Clinton takes longer than anyone expected to recover from this, will think more than twice about getting on the Sanders campaign.
Let's listen to a little bit of what the candidates actually said last night as we're having this conversation about where they go from here and what this means. Bernie Sanders told the crowd last night that Democrats are going to need to unite behind whomever the nominee winds up being. Let's hear him.
But I also hope that we all remember, and this is a message not just to our opponents, but to those who support me as well, that we will need to come together in a few months and unite this party and this nation, because the right-wing Republicans we oppose must not be allowed to gain the presidency.
So Sanders playing the role of the great uniter there. Let's hear from Hillary Clinton. She said the country needs solutions and action, not just anger.
People have every right to be angry. But they're also hungry. They're hungry for solutions. What are we going to do?
Clinton says she realizes that she, as a candidate, needs to do a better job of reaching an important demographic, though, as well.
I know I have some work to do, particularly with young people, but I will repeat again what I have said this week. Even if they are not supporting me now, I support them.
So we also got a note from Megan in Huntington on this question of young voters. And she says, despite being considered a millennial, I'm at the top of that age bracket. I find that I do not resonate with many of the attributes often ascribed to this generation. I'm encouraged by the number of my peers who are becoming interested and getting involved in the political process this election. I'm a Bernie supporter, but have been struck by how direct Hillary has been in admitting her need for my generation. I heard many mentions last night in wrap-up coverage of the New Hampshire primary of money earned and how it's going to translate into TV ads in the upcoming primary states. And Megan says, I'm a bit baffled by this, however. Most millennials don't actually watch broadcast television. We rely on streaming services. Who then are these TV ads targeting? So, Chris Galdieri, you know, what about that, this idea of the candidates now trying to attract the people that they're going to need, particularly in Hillary Clinton's case, these younger voters?
That's a great question. I think for Clinton, she doesn't need to win the millennial voters, but if she could cut into Sanders' margins there, even by just a few points, I think that would really help her going forward. So it might be the case that, you know, millennials who don't really feel like millennials, they might still watch broadcast television. They might still record things on their DVR and watch that. I also think both campaigns Actually, campaigns on both sides have been taking advantage of advertising on the web in apps. I felt like for the last few weeks, every time I made a move in Words with Friends, I saw a Bernie Sanders campaign ad.
Huh.
So, and you know, if you listen to Spotify or Pandora, again, you're encountering lots of political ads there. So I think it's not just television; it's going out on the web as well.
Although, you know, my 93-year-old grandmother plays Words with Friends, so maybe it is the target older demographic mm-hmm. there.
Could be.
Chris Caldieri, what about on the Republican side for the GOP? I mean, this was Donald Trump's night, and then followed by John Kasich, who many people were surprised to see him have such a strong second-place finish, although it should also be pointed out that he has spent most of his time and money in New Hampshire. And then we still have these other contenders who are still vying for their spot and where they're going to be on the Republican side. So moving forward to Nevada and South Carolina, what do you foresee? Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to see a very ugly campaign in South Carolina. I think Jeb Bush is going to be someone to keep an eye on. He still has a lot of money for his own campaign account. He still has a super PAC with, last time I checked, about $50 million at its disposal. In South Carolina is a state where, for instance, his brother won after a very rough campaign against John McCain in 2000, where he's already got the support of Lindsey Graham. And I could see that. I could see the Bush campaign really trying to take out Kasich and Rubio, and try to get it down to a three-person race between Trump and Bush and Cruz. And if that happens, I am not sure how that scenario plays out. But if you did have that situation, suddenly there would only be one "quote-unquote" establishment candidate for party actors, party leaders, whatever you want to call them, to get behind. And I think the danger for Kasich going into South Carolina is, you know, he's been running as something of a happy warrior. He's been presenting himself as, you know, a moderate, although, you know, his record as governor of Ohio is very conservative in many ways. But as you said, he's been up here in New Hampshire for so long that he doesn't have a staff. He doesn't have an organization. He doesn't have a voter file or any of those things that you need to compete down in South Carolina. So his challenge is going to be trying to get all of that up and running in 10 days. And that's a really tall order.
Well, we'll have to wait and see what happens. Chris Caldieri is a professor of politics at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm's College. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us, Chris.
Happy to be here.
We are talking about what happened yesterday as New Hampshire voters registered their preferences for who should represent them in the general election. Tell us what you see in the results. Who's got momentum? Who's on the way out? Anything that you think just isn't getting covered in the right way? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're chewing over the results of the New Hampshire primary, and we welcome your input. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a reflection or reaction on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm joined now by VPR's Peter Hirschfeld, who was at the Sanders campaign party last night in Concord, New Hampshire. Hi, Pete.
That song never gets old, does it, Jane?
Oh, no. I'm sure it's not in your head at all these days. And by Megan Remmel, professor of political science at Norwich University. Professor Remmel, were you watching the returns from Somewhere Fun last night?
Of course I was.
Where were you?
I was at WFFF up in Colchester.
Oh, so you didn't even go to New Hampshire?
Nah.
All right, so let's get right into it. Let's talk a little bit about what you guys saw in last night. So let's talk about the Democrats, and we'll do a little demographics here. Who went to Bernie and who went to Hillary? Professor Remmel?
Well, obviously, the age divide is still pretty pronounced. And I think part of that is that there is, with the older generations, middle-aged and older, there's a knowledge and kind of an acceptance of scandal around the Clintons and a concern about factors such as trustworthiness and kind of an acceptance that that's just kind of what you're going to get with the Clintons. Whereas with younger generations who don't necessarily remember or have a whole lot of knowledge about Whitewater or Lewinsky scandal or anything like that, they hear Benghazi, they hear emails, and then they start to find out more about the previous scandals of the Clinton administration in the 90s and are now getting really, really concerned about that trustworthiness factor. And that's not necessarily something she's going to be able to correct. I would agree with Chris that when he says that she probably can't overcome that generational divide, she can only try to lessen it.
Well, and she's getting a lot of help from, I guess, what we're calling Hillary Clinton surrogates, who really want to advise young women especially to support Hillary Clinton. We talked with Mary Heath. She's a New Hampshire state representative from Manchester, and she spoke with VPR's Annie Russell outside a polling place in her district yesterday. She said she's really disappointed in young women who are voting for Bernie Sanders.
The young women now have never not had all the rights that we have now. We're still fighting for a lot of them. I used to be an assistant superintendent, and I was the only woman in the room. And today, there are lots of women in lots of rooms, boardrooms, CEOs. So I think that the world has changed significantly, and they don't understand what's at risk in this election. And it's a scary time, and the issues are serious, and we have to stand up and stand up with Hillary.
Professor Remmel, is that going to fly with young women, that kind of scolding?
No. And obviously the comments from somebody like Gloria Steinem this weekend or Madeleine Albright, I think there is, with younger generations of women, there is this, there's going to be a female president before I die. It's going to happen. I mean, we've had a black president now. It's going to happen in my lifetime. Whereas, so I think they're less attached to the gender of the candidate because they think it's inevitable. Whereas older generations are starting to be concerned that this may not happen in their lifetime if it's not a, if there isn't somebody like a Hillary Clinton to come and shatter this glass ceiling, that if they don't elect her, that they may not get to experience this in their lifetime. And we see this around the world in countries that have transitioned into democracy in the last 20 or 25 years, where the older generations are very kind of disconnected from the younger generations and don't understand why they're so frustrated necessarily, because they've not seen what life could be like or how worse it could be. Whereas the younger generations, this is all they know. This is what life is going to be like.
And we saw Bernie Sanders win the female vote in New Hampshire yesterday. And we saw almost 70% of female voters who were 45 and younger vote in his favor. So we have the prospect of this first woman president, and intuitively we would all think that this would really draw women to the polls in favor of her, and it's just not materializing.
Let's go to the calls. Doreen's on the line with us from Warren. Hi, Doreen. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Actually, I'm from Burke, and I just wanted to say that I'm a Hillary supporter, and I believe that Hillary and a lot of other women have taken women a long way, and I would not want to go back to the way it was 25, 30 years ago, and I have to give her a lot of credit for that. And yes, I want to see a female president before I go. So thank you.
Doreen, thanks for your call, echoing Megan Remmel's point there that especially for older women, this takes on a different level of importance and a different level of urgency. Thanks for your call. Raphael and Barry, go right ahead. Raphael, you're on the air.
Guys, the only problem I have with the media in general is what happened yesterday. Everybody knows why, because you guys are expert in your field, and I know you guys know why, but you will not say it. The reason why Hillary lost by 20 points is because women, men, everybody in this country, they don't want her. Because everybody knows you guys do not have the courage to tell. People don't want to pull up with all the nonsense, with Benghazi, with the criminal investigation that is taking place right now, the FBI, all of those things is a complete rejection. As a matter of fact, what Bernie Sanders did, it just shined a light to the whole Democratic Party. Like me, I'm a blue blood Democrat. I used to love Nancy Pelosi. I used to love Harry. I used to love Chuck. But by Bernie Sanders coming over and put the light, flash the light on these people now, I realize how dirty, how nasty these people are. And I promise you, the reason all these people are fighting tooth and nail is because they know not only Wall Street days are over, all of these people, their days also are over. We're going to clean that mess, and we're going to put true, true, clean politicians that are going to do the business of the people for the people.
Raphael, I hear you. I hear what you're saying. And Pete Hirschfeld, let me give this to you, because I would push a little against what Raphael is saying. We are hearing from people like him, from supporters of Bernie Sanders, who say, this is why I support this candidate. I mean, I feel like those voices are certainly being heard at this point. But what do you think? He's saying, you know, we're still not talking enough about this margin of victory, or it sounds like he thinks not talking about Bernie Sanders like he's on the role that he clearly is at the moment.
Well, I think there is a justifiable frustration among people that have been supporters of Bernie Sanders for some time now, who feel like everybody else is just sort of catching up with the reality of this moment and understanding the strength of the current that Bernie Sanders has tapped into. You know, Raphael said he thinks that the decision that we saw yesterday was a rejection of Hillary Sanders. When you see record turnout, though, it's hard to imagine that people came out to vote against somebody. I think it was
Hillary Clinton, you mean?
Correct. Yeah. When we see record turnout like that, I think a lot of people might say they were out there to vote for Bernie Sanders, that this was an inspiration vote as opposed to a frustration vote. And of course, there is enormous frustration among some of Bernie Sanders' supporters with the status quo in politics today, with the amount of money that's in politics. But the target of their frustration, at least according to a lot of the folks that I talked to, was less personified by Hillary Clinton than it was with the system as a whole. To the extent that she represents that, they're saying they're not going to be voting for her. But I saw people who were far more inspired by a candidate than they were antagonized by another.
Let's go to Nancy in Warren. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to express my support for Bernie, first of all. But I was confused about what you said regarding the delegates. Did you state that more delegates were awarded to Hillary in New Hampshire than to Bernie?
Yes, Nancy, and it looks like 13 delegates have been awarded to Bernie Sanders and 15 go to Hillary Clinton. And that's because of not just the popular vote, but as we were discussing with Chris Galdieri, the way these superdelegates work, where they don't have to necessarily go with the popular vote. They can pledge their support to the candidate that they like better.
Well, I will also express that I surely hope that someday in the near future we do away with the delegates and the Electoral College, and I will leave it at that, because I'd like my vote to be my vote only.
Nancy,
and thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. Pete Hirschfeld, I hear you breathing in.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, some of this stuff really does, it makes your brain hurt trying to understand why things work the way they do. And the process is incredibly complex, and I think it's hearing that sort of news that after his 20-point win in New Hampshire, Bernie Sanders will be awarded fewer delegates from that state than the person that he defeated only feeds this sense of distrust and in a system that folks are in increasing numbers, it seems, saying they're not going to tolerate anymore.
Though I do have to say that those superdelegates, they are not pledged. They're not
right.
Bound. So the ones that have come out as endorsing Hillary Clinton, there's nothing stopping them from changing their vote before the convention. So theoretically, she has more right now out of New Hampshire because of how the superdelegates have shaken out. But there's nothing binding about that until the convention happens.
And certainly there's plenty of historical precedent for pledged superdelegates changing
switching
their
sides.
Tune at the nominating convention.
Well, and we often see candidates who drop out who have had some of these superdelegates sort of releasing their superdelegates and suggesting to them, you might want to support this candidate who I am now backing because I'm out of the race.
Correct.
Let's go to a listener comment we have here from Stephen in Heartland, who says, I was raised in Salem, New Hampshire in the 60s and 70s in a very political family, but I've lived most of my adult life in Vermont. We keep hearing commentators attributing part of Bernie's success to the fact that Vermont and New Hampshire are neighbors. For the people in the large voting block within the Golden Triangle of Concord, Manchester, and Nashua, which also includes Salem and Portsmouth, Massachusetts is their neighbor. Many of them or their parents moved to New Hampshire from Massachusetts within the last 30 years. For them, Vermont might as well be Montana, a great place to go skiing. Sure, it's different here in the Upper Valley, where we have a shared culture and economy in the Twin State region, but I believe the voters in populous southern New Hampshire voted for Bernie on his merits as a national candidate. And Professor Remmel, I would say certainly in Vermont, we're familiar with this idea that New Hampshire and Vermont are not the same place, and we're not just voting for the same people.
As someone who's lived in Vermont only 2.5 years, I will admit that I, too, shared the idea that Vermont and New Hampshire must have been pretty similar. And then I got here and found out that that is not the case. I think your listener is correct that we're attributing some credit to geography that isn't necessarily responsible for Bernie Sanders doing that well. New Hampshire is split in different media markets, and most of the population is not in a media market that's getting a lot of coverage from Vermont. It is kind of Massachusetts area. So he wasn't necessarily as super well known in the more populous southeastern part of New Hampshire as he is on kind of the border region. So I think your listener is dead on.
A listener in Walden wrote, "I'm a second wave feminist and I'm supporting Bernie Sanders. I want a major change. My main concern is the salvation of the middle class. A vote for Bernie Sanders is all about people and restructuring of government systems. Sure, I would love a woman, but I am a human first and then a woman, mother, etc." Travin Leishen is a Vermonter who campaigned for Bernie Sanders in New Hampshire. We have a tape of what he was saying. He says he's really focused here now on the long game.
So he may actually pull it out. That's possible. We see momentum like no one expected, and we're going to work like hell to make sure that we have a Sanders administration coming out of this election. But it doesn't end there. You know, if he doesn't win at that convention, it's not going to end there. There's going to be organizing that's going to continue in all 50 states around a political project which represents the interests of working people, and that will be a breath of fresh air in this country.
So, Pete Hirschfeld, what happens next? I mean, Travin there looking at the long game.
So I actually talked to Travin yesterday. That's where he got that tape. And I said to Travin, so what exactly are you talking about? And he said, I don't know yet. That's the thing. We're still figuring this out as we go. But there are too many examples from movements past where the people that were a part of them failed to construct any lasting infrastructure from the mood of that moment. And I think that there's a growing sense among the people that are really at the heart of this, the people that are doing the volunteering, the people that are getting out the vote, working on their own time, their own dime to make this happen, that they need to seize this moment in a way that is going to sort of institutionalize it, create a legacy that will continue to build this progressive movement that they think they've started into the future in a way that movements, say, like Occupy didn't. Travin actually mentioned the Rainbow Coalition when Jesse Jackson was running two consecutive cycles. And he said, you know, I really thought we were going to be able to translate that into something concrete and lasting. And he said it got away from us and they don't want to let the same thing happen this time around.
So jumping off that then, Megan Remmel, I mean, you're seeing this sort of sense of a movement here, and we keep hearing that from people, but this is a long way through a tough slog, and it's going to get very political, and it gets very horse racy. So what do you see coming up next?
It's going to be interesting. I think we already saw the beginnings of it last night in the speeches from both Clinton and Sanders. Clinton, on Sunday, had clearly moved on from New Hampshire, at least mentally. I mean, being physically in Flint, Michigan. But even when she went back to New Hampshire, she had clearly moved on. She had recognized that this was not going to be a repeat of 2008. And so she has moved on. And her what was essentially a stump speech was very much appealing to the populations that are in her wheelhouse that are not necessarily in Sanders' wheelhouse in terms of minority populations. So I'm going to be interested to see if Sanders really can take this amazing momentum, this monumental momentum, and actually convert it into something, or if it ends up petering out and that ending up hurting the Democrats in the long run because generally enthusiasm dies out on the Democratic side of the race.
Norwich University political scientist Megan Remmel and VPR's Peter Hirschfeld, thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
Coming up, what could be controversial about a bike lane? Well, it turns out in Burlington, lots. We'll explain next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A trial project with the aim of making a major Burlington roadway safer and more bike-friendly is running into some strong opposition and dividing a neighborhood. Bike lane trials have been tried elsewhere in Vermont with mixed results. Joining us now to explain the current controversy is 7Days staff writer Alicia Fries. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jane.
So the project in question is along North Avenue in Burlington, which for people who are only somewhat familiar with the city is a major thoroughfare. It runs through the northern end of the city towards Colchester. People might remember the DMV used to be up there. There's a police station, several schools. It's a big road. And right now it has two lanes of traffic in either direction. And the idea is to bring that down to three lanes, one lane of traffic in either direction, a center turning lane, and then bike lanes on either side. So what's the problem, first of all, that this solution is trying to fix?
So the North Avenue is one of the more accident-prone streets in the city. There is an ongoing debate about whether it's actually the most accident-prone, and not
that's
having
a dubious
studied
distinction to want to get.
But the basic idea is there are a lot of crashes, and it's not a well-designed road. And so the idea of the pilot is to try something else, and in particular, try something that would make it, as you said, more bike-friendly and also more pedestrian-friendly.
And are the crashes mostly just involving cars, or have there been crashes with bikes and pedestrians?
There have been bike crashes. The majority are with cars.
So is the idea here to slow down traffic or just to make the flow of traffic safer for all users?
They're focused on the flow. And again, that's another thing that's kind of up for debate is whether or not reducing it. I mean, common sense would tell you that reducing a lane for cars would increase the traffic. The people who are overseeing the study say that's not actually necessarily the case, but the idea is to, really facilitate that flow.
But this is running into some controversy. Why?
Well, so it actually, it's been this kind of long brewing issue. They've been talking about this for a few years now. And last year with the city council elections out in the New North End, it was a major issue then. But then it kind of seemed like, the city council approved this project. It seemed like things were moving forward, and kind of under the radar, this group of residents started a petition to get an item on the ballot that would express support for keeping North Avenue four lanes. And the concern is people think that reducing the lanes of traffic will make their commutes longer, and they just think it's a terrible idea. And the other thing that's going on here is people have a sense that there are cyclists, really active cyclists, who are kind of driving the conversation, and they're making the case that the cyclists are a minority, and so to change North Avenue to benefit them is really unfair. And then the other thing that's going on is that they don't really buy the concept that this is a pilot. And, public officials throughout this have been very clear, if this doesn't work, if the data shows this doesn't work, and even if, they're saying, we'll take public opinion into account when we make this decision, we can go back to the old road configuration. There's a lot of mistrust that they will actually stick to that.
Because this is supposed to be a two-year trial project, right? So you'd take the lanes down to three and then see what happens?
I'm not clear on the exact time frame, and I think that's still kind of to be determined. I think it could be shorter.
So you were saying that sounds like the main complaint is that this will increase commuting times. There's not a lot of question among opponents about whether or not this would actually increase safety. It's really about how much more congestion there will be.
Well, they're saying, they're making the case that this safety isn't really a huge issue. I mean, they're kind of saying, we've got potholes out here. Why don't you fix the potholes? Why don't you focus on that? Like things are working just fine on North Avenue is the case that they are making.
So they've also succeeded in getting a note on the town meeting day ballot in Burlington. What does it actually say?
So
a resolution,
this,
I should say.
So they this has been another point of contention. They drafted language that the city attorney decided didn't really meet the legal standard, which put the city council in the position of they decided to draft a question for these people, which was a tough decision for some counselors. And the reason it was
because
tough...
they've unanimously supported it, right?
Correct, correct. And the question is basically asking, should North Avenue remain four lanes in this particular section that the pilot would change? And the concern among people who support the pilot is that, especially in other parts of the city outside of the New North End, where this has not been a major issue, the concern is that people are going to look at that question and say, I don't know, or sure, yeah, it should remain four lanes. They're not going to understand the context of the pilot project. And so they're now in the position of trying to get out there and educate people about what is the underlying intent of the question.
Oh, because this would go to all of the voters in Burlington, not just the people
right.
who live in that neighborhood.
Right.
So what are the people who support this project and the city officials who support this project saying to those who have the concerns that you just talked about?
Well, they are trying to be really clear that this is a pilot and that they will, you know, after the pilot, they will take into account a number of things. The data, the number of crashes, you know, the commuting times, and also just kind of how people feel about it. So the basic case they're making is just give us a chance to try this out, collect some data, see if it works.
Alicia, how big of an issue actually is this in this particular neighborhood?
It's huge. If you drive or bike or walk down North Avenue, you'll see signs from people on both sides of the issue. Four lanes for North Avenue, something like People for a Safer North Avenue. And it's gotten really divisive. You know, you have cyclists coming in to city council with stories about people harassing them on the street, and they say that's increased since this whole thing has become an issue. You know, it's certainly something the city councilors are hearing about all of the time. It is the major issue in the New North End right now.
Do you see it as opening up any other fissures in the community? I mean, is this only about bike lanes and commuting times, or does this somehow bring to light some other kind of neighborhood or community split?
Well, I think it does have implications for the rest of the city. I mean, the New North End is unique in Burlington in that it is more conservative than the rest of the city. And I think you're seeing this issue play out along those lines to a certain extent. And so I'm not sure you would necessarily encounter the same type of opposition to a similar project elsewhere in the city. But it's relevant to consider because the city is making a concerted effort to try to change streets to make them more bike-friendly and more pedestrian-friendly. That's one of the mayor's main goals. So I'm sure they are, you know, they're paying attention and thinking about what this means going forward. And another thing it's interesting to consider is that the other major road project coming up in Burlington, not imminently, but is the Champlain Parkway, which would be a new road running through the South End. And, you know, it's interesting to see this organized effort to oppose a public works project, get a question on a ballot. You have to think that the people, and there is a group of people who are expressing opposition to the Champlain Parkway, you have to think they are paying attention to this and, you know, maybe picking up some tips.
That question on the ballot at town meeting day is non-binding. So when and what is the resolution to this conflict?
Well, so that it will be really interesting to see what happens on town meeting day. The city councilors have, for the most part, avoided saying what effect the vote will have on their decision. I mean, I think it's unlikely that they would, if there were a strong majority supporting four lanes, which would be opposing the pilot, that's how they would interpret it. I think it's unlikely they would revisit. I think they would still go ahead with the pilot project. But it will put them in this position of, you know, basically having to say, we don't think the majority opinion is relevant in this decision.
remains to be seen then what exactly will happen after town meeting day.
Right.
Well, we'll look to your reporting for that. Alicia Fries is a staff writer for 7 Days, and she's been telling us about this proposed bike lane trial on North Avenue in Burlington. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that does it for today's show. It's the time of year when we focus on love, despite controversies in various neighborhoods. So tomorrow, we're going to get advice on the keys to a long-lasting relationship. We'll also hear about the ability to be creative with designer relationships and how to embrace being single. Send your questions or comments about love and relationships to vermontedition@vpr.net and then listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.